Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today, we're joined again by Portfolio Manager and Director of Research Joe Overdevest for another panel discussion. Host Pamela Ritchie and Joe are joined by Equity Research Analysts Nicholas Belmare and Andrew Hall. The panel will be discussing the impact and stability a decided U.S. election brings to the economy, outlooks for stimulus, and a deeper look at both Canadian financials and industrials in the current market. Additionally, Joe provides his thoughts on where energy will go from here, and how the Canadian energy landscape has changed through the pandemic. Today's podcast was recorded on November 10th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Welcome to each of you.
Thanks a lot, Pamela.
It's great to be here.
And great to see you again.
Very happy to have all of you joining us here today. Joe, I'll begin with you if you don't mind. So, as we mentioned there, is this the reflation trade, the so-called reflation trade, and what does it mean for Canada?
Pamela, history will tell us if we're right or wrong, but the ingredients are definitely there. Number one, we had a pandemic. Like, essentially, major industries around the world were shut down. Potentially, we'll talk about that today with a vaccine. We could have those opening it up. Number two is we have fiscal and monetary policy that we talked about on the show is definitely, like, historically at very, very high levels. And number three is expectations for certain commodities and certain just value-like sectors are very low. So we will see.
Very interesting. So the election obviously has happened since the last time that we all spoke about this. We have so-called divided government, a more middle of the road in terms of political speak president, it looks like, and a slim majority, it looks like, for Republicans in the Senate. Generally, that's good for markets. Any consequences that you want to point to? Unintended, perhaps expected? What should we know that you're looking at?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think for the world, it was the most watched election ever, and that was more dramatic than the House of Cards. But when it comes to what the market was pricing in was that it potentially was a blue sweep. And a blue sweep, the biggest thing for the markets was more stimulus. And so you actually, ironically, to your original question, you started seeing value stocks starting getting bid up, maybe stay-at-home winners and tech stocks not doing as well. All of a sudden, the election came, they didn't get a blue sweep. So all of a sudden, the tech companies started going up again, and then the value stocks started trading down. And of course, Monday's news came and it totally reversed it as well. So I think you're seeing a lot of actually flow trade that is like people trying to anticipate these things. And as you can imagine, elections are very tough to anticipate. So as you've heard us say before, we tried not to, but that's explaining what was going on in the marketplace. But generally, blue sweep or not, we definitely will expect some stimulus at some point in time.
It's very interesting. And we'll get perhaps more into what we're seeing in the markets right now. It's only Tuesday, you know, here we are, the people are holding on for this amazing ride here. So we need your perspective on that. Nick, I'll go to you next. I want to ask a little bit about what the reflation trade, again, you can tell us whether you agree with that or not, means for financials across the boards here in Canada and then maybe on a broader basis.
Yes, happy to do that. I think clearly the vaccine news that we had, and if the market is going to look forward to an eventual vaccine, is a good development for banks. And I think it helps mainly on three fronts. Number one is credit. So we finally have a line of sight for some of the industries that have been the most impacted. We think of travel, commercial, real estate, leisure, and so on, to eventually have a path towards going back to a normal level of demand. And perhaps, you know, be able to put the credit cycle behind us. And so I think that's positive for the sentiment on the banks. Number two is for just general level of activity in the economy. If we get to that point where we have a vaccine there will just be more ways to basically spend money. I don't know about you, but my credit card bill declined quite dramatically, especially in the early days of the pandemic. And so for banks, I mean, less interchange revenue, less loan growth, a lot of just revenue pressures in general that should revert as we head to a more normalized world. And the last thing is rates. We've certainly seen long rates going up a little bit on the news. Look, it'll be interesting to see if there's a lot of follow through. I think there's limited scope for a huge rate cycle just because we still have so much debt out there that a lot of governments can't afford a huge increase in rates, and central banks are certainly behind that. But just to have a bit of an increase in rates and steepness in the yield curve, it does, you know, help at least stabilize the NIM that the banks have been suffering some pressure there.
It's fascinating. And Andrew, I'll bring you in at this point to sort of talk a little bit of a divided story for industrials. I mean, certainly the rails have continued to roll along to some extent, but the airplanes have not, certainly not to the same degree. How do you look at industrials across this country right now?
Yeah, Pamela. So it's really interesting. It might be a little bit surprising, but year to date, actually, industrials are the third best performing sector in the TSX, outperforming consumer staples and utilities, which would be considered sort of defensive sectors in a cyclical risk-off environment. But within Canada, there's sort of a bifurcated market for industrials where a lot of the heavier weights in the index, like you mentioned, in the Canadian National Railway or Canadian Pacific, both Waste Connections and Thomson Reuters, are good, strong, stable companies that can do quite well even in times of economic uncertainty. And in fact, investors like them even more because they feel comfortable and confident about their outlook and future. So those stocks have done very well up until this point, but maybe on a relative basis, don't benefit as much from a vaccine or a reopening of the economy. And then on the other side, like you mentioned, nothing's been more downbeat than aerospace, you know, whether that's commercial aerospace and the suppliers, or of course the airlines. And so there's no doubt that the prospect of a vaccine or prospect of therapeutics that sort of allow the economy to reopen, travel to restart, takes away some of the tail risk that exists in the airlines that travel might stay depressed for an extended period. But the vaccine, because there's still a period between when it would get approved and when it would be distributed, doesn't necessarily mean it's a fix-all for the fundamentals of the airlines in the near term.
So interesting. Joe, coming back to you, you know, yesterday we actually spoke with Yuri and Timur a little bit about this idea of the durability of a rotation, and it brings together a lot of different thoughts. And, you know, what do you think on that front? Like, are there things that could upset this so-called rotation, or what are they? And what are the prospects for durability here?
Yeah, I think that's why history will tell us if we're right or wrong, because as it stands here, there's definitely opportunity, but there's lots of things that could upend us. And, you know, sometimes even political things that you haven't thought of, that there's an upheaval in the U.S. and the stimulus doesn't come through as much as you think. Obviously, I think we talked about this before, too. Even within the sectors, you really have to watch, because, you know, very easily you could say, oh, it's reflation, oil resources go up, but the supply demand for oil doesn't look as tight as it is for maybe for copper or for lumber, right? So there's going to be some winners and losers even within a reflation market. And I think the obvious one would be the handoff. If, you know, for humanity's sake, hopefully we get to the other side of this, that the handoff, there's a lot of unemployed people who are getting us, luckily, some money from the government, that handoff is smooth. And sadly, some of those businesses they may go to, like restaurants, may not be open on the other side. So there's definitely some disruption there. And the governments at this point are doing everything they can to do that handoff properly. But that is probably what the biggest concern I have is when we get to the other side.
Interesting. And, you know, today, as we said at the opening, we're focusing really on financials, on industrials. But, Joe, I have to ask you, I mean, these energy markets are wild. What do we sort of need to keep top of mind watching some of these stocks are being run up, you know, over 20%. It's sort of unbelievable.
Yeah, I think, Pamela, what's happening is that you have obviously supply demand was loose with oil. Again, some of the things we've talked about in the past is that oil and gas is a perfect example that the demand for oil, the last, say, 10, 30% of that industry was really tough because we're all working from home, we're not traveling as much. But that Monday news was a big catalyst for, again, the markets are pricing in at some point that we will have more mobility, more moving around, and that last 10 or 30%, depending on the region, will start gaining back. So supply and demand got tighter. And then number two is valuations were just so discounted, especially in Canada. We've talked about this before. They're very discounted, some to some degree, for ESG reasons. But more importantly, the supply and demand was loose. That definitely tightened things up. And so you had the ingredients for definitely a rally in the stocks.
Right. So interesting. Nick, let's come back. You mentioned credit cards there and whether people are, you know, spending more. I'm buying everything online. It seems actually the credit card is where all the spending is happening. But I'm curious what you think about the consumer. Many will say that the banks, some of the financial institutions are, as we know, in pretty good shape after so many of the change arounds after the great financial crisis. But where is the consumer, or how much do you focus on that when you're looking sort of across the financials landscape?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the consumer, it's been a very interesting. I think this downturn, if you have your nose stuck in your spreadsheets, you would have missed a lot of what's going on because you had to be focused a lot on policy. And the reality is this recession has been mostly induced by shutdowns, you know, government shutdowns in response to the virus. And so the view from the government is that a lot of people, consumers, maybe got a shutdown of their jobs, could not work as much through, you know, perceived no fault of their own. And so the government did feel a burden to support a lot of the, you know, their consumers through this tougher period. And so if you looked at, you know, GDP collapsing 40%, unemployment is going to double digits, you would think the banks would suffer a tremendous loss and the consumer balance sheets would be in bad shape. But that's not what we've seen, just because the government has been running heavy deficits to support consumers. Actually, what we've seen is the savings rates go up, consumer reducing their leverage, discretionary income improving, because a lot of the job losses have been concentrated in this category just because of the nature of which industries have been impacted. They were concentrated in jobs that perhaps earn $16 per hour or less. And when you think of that category and the government programs offering often like $500 per week, this has been a substantial income replacement for where most of the job losses have been. So perhaps the impact on the consumer has not been as dramatic. There will be some suffering, but not as bad as if you just stuck to the headlines.
Interesting. While we're on the topic of government, Andrew, I'll bring you in on the sort of the sense of what do we need to know about industrials as the government, you know, attempts to get us out of this. And obviously the vaccine is a big part of that. And we can sort of bring that discussion generally in. But, you know, spending, do we see infrastructure spend? What do we need to be watching for on sort of the industrial side with the government involved in getting us out of this recessionary period?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a unique time, as Nick mentioned, in terms of the level of fiscal stimulus and monetary accommodation, as well as the type and the way that we've implemented it. It's quite unusual to see sort of these direct payments where the government has been trying to stimulate the consumer directly, whether that's through the emergency response benefit or through the direct wage subsidy for large employers, as opposed to sort of taking more indirect measures that they might have in the past, like an infrastructure bill that says we'll eventually trickle that down through to other people. So there's no doubt that there's been some economic stimulus that's going through the industrial economy via stimulus for infrastructure. But I think that the more consumer-focused stimulus maybe reduces the probability that we'll see a big wave of new bridges and roads and tunnels that can support the sort of engineering construction companies. On the flip side, of course, when you strengthen the consumer, as Nick mentioned, people are buying more stuff. And when they're buying more stuff, that means things need to be shipped more. And of course, you've seen beneficiaries like, you know, Transports International, a trucking company, or Cargojet, or to a lesser extent, the rails, where they've started to really benefit from this shift to the consumer economy and the e-commerce parcels that they need to be moved.
Sure. That's really interesting. I mean, today we saw Trudeau talking. It's sort of been discussed for a while, but there might be a real push into getting internet for everyone. And I know that's sort of a telecom story, but it's also they physically have to build some of these networks. And is that anything that you look at, just attaching to the headlines, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you always have to take into account the sort of total level of spending on various construction infrastructure projects. The telcos, if they're expanding internet, probably isn't a huge needle mover for most of the public companies that I would look at. Okay. But on the margin, it could be a benefit.
Interesting. Let's go. There's so many questions rolling in here. I have a couple more for each of you, but we'll fold those in as we go along. Joe, if you can take us to your thoughts for the Canadian dollars, question coming in from one of the advisors, what is happening globally? We always compare it obviously to the US dollar, but what else do we need to know about watching the Canadian dollar, our currency?
The Canadian dollar really hasn't moved a whole lot in the last few years. As we know, probably is probably more like 5 years ago, there's that big move where there's a devaluation. Probably the outlook, again, as always, we've talked about this before, currencies are, it's a relative game, right? So how the US dollar does or the yen does or euro does, that's what actually just as much determine how our own internal finances are here in Canada. I would sum it up, it seems like we're all kind of almost in a holding period for maybe the Canadian dollar in particular, because we're all doing fiscal and monetary stimulus, right? And so it's not like one country really stands out. If anything, they're trying to step over each other how much stimulus they have. So I think on the margin, probably we probably have a little bit of benefit, though, if supply and demand for commodities do well, that will give us a small benefit for sure that we haven't seen probably in a while.
Here's a commodities, well, related commodities question coming in. So I'll put this to you, Joe. Canadian pipelines. The question is, do you see a lot of risk here in the pipeline sector side of the energy market?
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, Pamela. We do a lot of work, and as Nick said, this is one of those ones where if you stick your head in the Excel sheet, you kind of miss it. Is that 10 years ago, actually, I remember talking to you, Pamela, about this. It was like, you know, pipelines, there was really no debate. Like a pipeline would go across Vancouver, or sorry, like a British Columbia or Calgary or whatever, Alberta to the U.S. It doesn't really matter where it was coming from, it was going. Now it's almost everything is being questioned. And even ones that just stay inside of Canada. And so I think the social fabric has changed, and that I think I know ourselves, we've put a lot of risk on it. Obviously, we hope for, you know, that, you know, these companies can get these projects done for the benefit of Canada. But, you know, when we look at, you know, the locals and at the and the federal levels, a lot of people have a major issue with oil and gas pipelines. And so we put a lot of risk on it. I think it's something to watch because you have a lot of these pipeline companies have a lot of debt and they have very high dividend payout ratios. If some of their pipelines don't get built, or even scarier, there's some U.S. politicians are saying they would like to shut some pipelines down. That could be very meaningful. So I think it's a very good question to raise. And it's definitely something we flagged over the last few years in our views of the pipeline sector.
Nick, I'll ask you to sort of give us the different areas within the financial services area that you cover when you're thinking about this question. So there are overall questions about where value and growth come into play and whether you want to put those labels on them. I mean, financials have been seen as a sort of a value play lately. But spell out for us sort of the areas within financials that you cover and, you know, where there might be some subtleties that we need to know about in sort of this value growth discussion.
Mm-hmm. I think when you look at a financial, there's usually one of three types of risk, either market risk, credit risk, or interest rate risk. And you kind of just want to understand which type of risk you're taking and what may be improving. Right now, for instance, the vaccine drove a little bit of a better sentiment on credit and interest rate risk, which I both talked about earlier, which is really where the banks play. So they have more leverage to this type of recovery. When you think of an asset manager, you're taking more of a market risk. And some companies are more secular grower. They're not as exposed to any of these risks. And so those would be perhaps like financial infrastructure companies, like exchanges or payment companies that are more driven about either the volatility in the markets or the flow of transactions.
And where do some of these subtleties, Andrew, come in, value versus growth? You did mention within industrials, you can kind of look at it as a bit of a bifurcation. But within that, does that mean those that have done reasonably well will see a rotation out of them? How do you look at the value growth discussion within industrials?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think it's one of the biggest questions the market itself is trying to answer and trying to figure out. Clearly within industries, you don't have the same level of hypergrowth that you do at the very top with technology stocks. But it's more about sort of the certainty and quality of certain types of businesses, like the railroads that have spent hundreds of years or 100 years building their infrastructure. And there's no real concern that if the economy is gone or lower for a year or two, that's really going to mean anything long term for their business. But then on the flip side, like we mentioned, there were maybe more secular changes in areas like airlines, or engineering construction with distancing and preventing sort of activity. And then, of course, more economically sensitive businesses, whether that's tied to the resource economy, so equipment sellers or equipment dealers. And so I think the question really is still, even with the vaccine more maybe on the horizon, maybe faster or better than we thought, the question still is there's a lot of uncertainty between now and the distribution and success of that vaccine and even post that. How strong is the economy? How much stimulus came through the system? And does that really support sort of the valuations for these cyclicals when they get back to something that, you know, looks like normal? And that's kind of our job, really, is to, you know, rifle through these and figure out which ones aren't pricing in normal and which ones are.
So tell us a little bit more about the equipment makers, distributors, what they've seen. I mean, some of this has been the discussion of a bit of a stay at home or stay closer to home play. But what do we sort of need to know within there? Which ones within that might see some lift if the overall economy lifts?
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting one. In Canada, you really have two major equipment dealers, Finning, which covers a Caterpillar supplier, which covers most of Western Canada, and of course Toromont, which covers more of Eastern Canada. And so even within the bifurcation within that specific sector of industrials, you've seen a big difference where Finning tied to the Alberta economy, which is of course a derivative of kind of energy markets, versus Ontario, which is more kind of consumer financial driven and has benefited from, you know, strong housing. Certainly Toromont's fundamentals have been much, much stronger, whereas Finning has seen, had to take substantial cost actions, restructure, take cost out of the business year after year, as the oil sands producers that are primarily their customers need to take out more cost out of their business so they can be profitable at lower oil prices.
Fascinating. Nick, what about dividends? When we spoke last time, financials look like, I mean, a lot of people are exposed to financials in Canada and other places around the world because they have huge dividends. Any reason to look at that any differently than you did a few months ago?
No, my call last time was the major banks would not cut their dividends, and so far it's proven the right call, and I think it is still the case going forward. Banks cut their dividends when they run out of capital, or the regulator gets uncomfortable with their capital position. So far, capital has been resilient in this downturn. We talked about fiscal support. We talked about the potential for eventual normalization of the economy, and the fact that banks have already, you know, they came in with strong capital levels. They've been able to build big provisions for credit losses that they yet have to fully utilize. So when I put it all together, again, I can never say never. There can be a really adverse outcome for the economy in which they have to, but has things look today, we'll probably get to the other side of this without the need for dividend cuts amongst the large Canadian banks.
How do people need to, when they watch headlines about digital currencies taking greater hold, greater interest, we look at basically Silicon Valley companies that are working their way into sort of financials, and you watch Ant Financial in China, for instance. Any concerns for so-called typical banks that we have in Canada? I mean, how do they make sure that they're in good shape to fight off some of those trends that clearly are in the market?
Yeah, I think it's something to watch. I mean, because whenever Silicon Valley is going after your industry, you can talk to bookstores or any industry like that. They'll tell you it's very deflationary. And so, you know, banks charge up a lot of their income coming from different types of fees that they charge for things like, you know, payments and, you know, cross-border payments. And if technology can do it better, more efficiently, like those fees are going to come down and it's going to eat into the bank's, you know, revenue and profits. I would say in Canada, the development is typically slower, partly because, you know, we have an oligopoly, but also, you know, the regulator is hesitant of opening the door to fintechs. And so we're behind on like things like open banking. And so you can see around the world and see what trends may come up. And certainly what we've seen in this downturn, like with in the US, some for instance, the Cash App, which people used to for transferring money to one another, but increasingly is becoming almost a little bank in your mobile phone. Those are interesting developments. And when we think 5-10 years down the road, they mean probably some pressure on the banks. And so we have to, this is certainly part of very active part of the discussions we have with CEOs of the bank when we meet them. Are they thinking right through that? And so that's a point of focus for us.
I'm going to turn to Joe to wrap us up here on some trade questions in a second, but just sort of yes or no on this one, Nick, because we don't have a ton of time here. Concerned about mortgages in Canada?
Generally not. I guess some focus on the condo space, but I mean, housing has been pretty strong through the downturn, so not a big concern at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Joe, lots of questions coming in here about really Biden and trade and how it shakes out for Canada. Just want to kind of ask you to address that and maybe just fold in again sort of the market dynamic you think we're in right now.
But, yeah.
Again, you're watching, but trade first.
Trade first. The answer first is it looks better than it was with the previous administration. We'll see. But the biggest thing probably we're seeing of a change is that when we talk to CEOs, global CEOs, Canadian CEOs, it's just knowing certainty. And the biggest thing about markets, about CEOs and company decisions is having certainty, even if it's good or bad, just having certainty. And they feel probably a little better with the Biden administration. And more importantly, not even that it may benefit Canadian relations with the U.S., but in particular, the U.S.'s relations around the world and the trade there. Because again, the more the U.S. economy does well, the more we do well. And in particular for the markets, I don't need to tell the people on this call, but like when people are tweeting stuff who are part of the administration and driving markets up or down or certain sectors up or down, it's not a healthy environment for anybody. And when we have a knock-on effect with our sectors, even when someone in the U.S. does that. So it looks to be more stability, which is positive.
So great to get your thoughts. Nick, thank you for joining us. Andrew, thank you for joining us. Joe Overdevesso, always glad to see you on these panel discussions. And good for everyone to know that these eagle eyes are watching over these very quick and dynamic moves in the market that we're watching right now. Thanks to each of you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Pamela.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.